Thank you, John and Jeremy, for giving me the opportunity to speak. So I want to tell you a little bit about Salvation Free Energy today. So if you have a flat solid, a slab of solid material, then the typical way to define whether that material is hydrophilic or hydrophobic, and I'm talking, this is both an experimental technique and a simulation technique, is to put a droplet of water onto the surface and measure the contact angle. And by definition, if the contact angle is less than 90 degrees, the material is classified as hydrophobic, and if the contact angle is greater than 90 degrees, the material is hydrophilic. The cosine of the angle gives the surface tension. And what I have at the bottom here is a potential energy function between a single water molecule and the entire slab, the entire solid surface. I won't tell you how I got it just yet, but it's a functional form. There's a parameter in it, epsilon, which is an energy, has units of energy. And as you change epsilon from 110 through 270, you change the nature of the surface from hydrophobic to hydrophilic. And I'll be focusing today on epsilon equals 250 because I want a hydrophilic surface. So that's one method. There's an independent method to assess whether the material is hydrophobic or hydrophilic. You set up a simulation with a slab of water on top of a slab of the solid material, and from the anisotropy and the pressure tensor, you can directly evaluate the surface tension. And so this is the cumulative surface tension as a function of time for different values of epsilon, which is just the cosine of the angle of the droplet. But this is not a droplet now. And again, you can see the epsilon equals 250 case has a negative surface tension, roughly minus 10 dynes per centimeter, which classifies that material as hydrophilic. Just for reference, the yellow curve here, which is hard to see, would correspond to graphite, which is weakly hydrophobic. Okay, now I have this functional form between a single water molecule and the entire slab. And what I want to do now is I want to curve this solid material into a sphere. So how do you do that? Well, first you have to know where this slab functional form comes from. And so typically it comes from the following argument, that you have a water molecule sitting above the solid slab, flat slab, and you imagine the slab consists of some crystalline lattice of atomic sites. And there's a pairwise interaction between the water molecule and each lattice site, which is typically Leonard Jones in nature, although here I'll just denote it by little u of r. So small u of r is the site-site potential. And now, as an approximation, you can integrate over the slab. So basically, you smear out the lattice sites in the slab and do an integral approximation, and you sum up all the sites, and you get a potential between a single water molecule and the entire slab, which, of course, depends only on the height above the slab. And so you can set up the integral here. The thing to notice is you can do two of the three integrals without knowing what the functional form of the site-site potential is. To take the last step, you need to fill in some functional form. But I want to stop here, actually. Okay, so this is the link I want to take to the next slide. So what we just saw is for the flat case, if I know the flat slab water potential, which I wrote down for you, because it has a parameter in it which I can dial to change the surface from hydrophilic to hydrophobic. what I can do is I can use this relationship, I can take two derivatives, and I can, knowing this, I can back out the site-site potential, little u of r, okay, from this, just by taking two derivatives here. And so once I've backed out the site-site potential, I can now curve the solid into a sphere and do the same thing, blur out the sites, the lattice sites on the sphere, and do an integral approximation, right? So it's an exact, you can do the spherical integral exactly, and you get, so you get some new functional form. So this is now, the bottom equation is now the potential energy between a single water molecule and the entire spherical solid. And the way I've written it, it's a function of two variables, the big R, which is the radius of the sphere, and little d, which is the distance between the water molecule and the nearest sphere surface location. And that parameter epsilon is sitting in this functional form. So we still have that handle on whether the surface is going to be hydrophilic or hydrophobic. Okay, so just to show you, so for this epsilon equals 250 case, if you just plot, so now, so here I'm plotting distance from the sphere center to the water, to a water molecule versus potential energy for different values of the radius. And what you notice is that the well depth, well, it converges to the at large radius to the flat limit, the zero curvature or infinite radius limit. But at small radius, the well depth decreases until actually at small enough radius, the potential energy function looks more or less like a hard wall potential. And that's simply a matter of the geometry of the material. But I want you to keep this in mind because this is ultimately what changes the material from hydrophilic to hydrophobic at small length scale. Okay, so what I showed you the last couple slides is that we have a potential energy function, analytic function, between the entire spherical nanoparticle and a single water molecule. And you can transform variables, so you can write the potential as a function of little r and big R. Big R is the sphere radius. Little r is the distance between the liquid atom and the center of the sphere. Now, if you take the gradient of that potential with respect to little r, with respect to the center mass separation between the two particles, that is the force that you need to do molecular dynamics simulations. So that's just the usual force in MD simulations. And so that I need to, you know, to evolve the equations of motion. But there's another gradient I could take. I'm allowed to take the gradient of that potential with respect to the sphere radius variable. That's not something I use during the simulation because the sphere radius is fixed, but I'm still allowed to calculate that on the fly during the simulation and just keep track of it. And in fact, doing that gives me a very powerful quantity because if you do an equilibrium simulation and measure and average this quantity over the length of the simulation, you have what's called the mean force of constraint on the sphere radius. So what I've done is I have done simulations of a single fixed radius sphere in a box of water. And I've done many simulations at, you know, for different size spheres. And I have simply kept track of this quantity, this gradient of potential with respect to the sphere radius, and averaged it over the length of the simulation. And so that's the mean force of constraint on the sphere radius. Now, that quantity, if it is negative, the way I'm defining it. There's always, you have a choice as to the sign. If that quantity is negative, that means that the sphere radius would like to contract, which means that the interface between the sphere and the water costs the system energy, and the system would rather get rid of that interface, and that can happen if the sphere shrinks. Now, I'm not allowing the sphere to shrink, but I can still measure how strongly the sphere would like to shrink if you let it change its radius. If the potential mean force on the sphere radius is positive, that means that the interface is favorable, and the interface would like to grow. In other words, the system gains free energy by growing the interface. And so the interesting thing that I'm showing you is that for this epsilon equals 250 case, which corresponds to a hydrophilic material, this potential mean force goes through zero, right? So it starts at zero, goes negative, and then at around one nanometer length scale crosses over and becomes positive and keeps going up. So if you take epsilon down small enough so that you have a hard wall potential between the sphere and the solvent, then the corresponding data would look like this, this blue curve here, which just keeps going down. And so in that case, the interface costs the system energy, to open up a cavity in the system costs energy. Okay. And there's a slight choice. There's two parallel curves here because there's a choice as to how you define the radius when you have a soft potential. You should add some van der Waals excluded volume onto the radius. So depending on how you choose that, this curve shifts a little bit, but the qualitatively it's the same, right? It's negative and then it goes positive. Okay. Now, if you integrate this curve versus sphere radius, you get the following plot. And so what you get is the solvation free energy. Why? Because if you start at zero radius, right, you can imagine what you're doing is you're growing the sphere into water. And so you integrate up the force of constraint up to the radius you want, and that's the energy cost of growing the sphere into water, which is the solvation free energy. So for the hard wall potential, which is in blue here, it goes off the scale quickly. I didn't want to show too much of it because then you wouldn't see this plot. So the hard wall potential shoots up quickly. And so this is done with the same method, with my method. And this is well known in the literature, the form of this function. So the solvation free energy for hard wall potential, which is the energetic cost to open a cavity of radius r in a fluid, goes up. Initially, it goes up like the volume of the cavity, r cubed. And at a length scale of 1 nanometer, 10 angstroms, which is already off the scale here, it crosses over to go up like the surface area of the cavity, 4 pi r squared. And that crossover from cubic to quadratic behavior is usually called the hydrophobic effect. And it's typically attributed in the literature to the hydrogen bonding structure of water, which for a small enough hydrophobic particle, the hydrogen bonding structure of water can retain its full complement of hydrogen bonds, but it's orientationally restricted to fit around the small particle. And so that's an entropic penalty, which goes up like the volume. And then when the particle or the cavity is big enough, water molecules near the surface must break their hydrogen bonds, and hence the energy is enthalpic in origin and goes up like the surface area of the ocean. So that's the standard argument in the theory. In the literature, which has to do with hydrogen bonding, which is not correct because you get the same curve for a Leonard-Jones solvent. So there's nothing about hydrogen bonding that's There's nothing special about hydrogen bonding for this data. Okay, so that's the, this is the sort of the canonical result. Now, what I've done is I've taken a hydrophilic object, and so what has to happen is that at large radius, the solvation free energy has to be negative, right, macroscopically, because the hydrophilic object likes water. But the solvation free energy goes up to a maximum, and the maximum, of course, is when the potential mean force crosses zero, and then comes down, although it's still positive, and then crosses zero at some point and becomes, in other words, the solvation free energy finally becomes favorable at around a length scale of 2 nanometers in this case, at radius, 2 nanometers radius. One way to think about this is that to introduce a hydrophilic particle into a solvent, you have to first make a cavity for it, and then you put the part, and that costs energy, and then you put the particle in, and the interface, if it's hydrophilic, will help the system, right? It's energetically favorable. So this curve shows that for radius under 2 nanometers, which is very common nowadays when people make nanoparticles, that's a typical size for nanoparticles, a hydrophilic material becomes hydrophobic. So I wanted to acknowledge my collaborators in this work, Wataru Shinoda, who I'm going to visit next month in Japan, Preston Moore in Philadelphia, and my current graduate student, Qicheng Chu. And thank you for your attention.